All right. Welcome to the Life Without Limits podcast. Hi, my name is Yogi Roth. Still figuring out the whole music thing off the top, but I want to welcome everybody in. This is the first real, true interview episode, and I am jacked. I want to say thank you for everybody listening to the welcome episode. I know the audio was a little iffy. Trying to figure out this blue ball of a microphone, and I think I got it figured out now. It's pretty rad. So anyway, today's episode, we're going to get right to it. I am Jack. It's with my mom. That's right. It's my mom. And when I looked at this podcast, I said, look, man, I want to talk about people going for it. And I've tried to live a life like that. And I learned it from somebody. And she taught and raised multiple kids. She's got an epic story of her own. And if we don't learn the stories of the people that we love and that raised us, I think we're really missing out. You know, I've been really lucky. I got to do a documentary on my dad called Life in a Walk that a lot of you have supported, where we walked through Spain and Portugal along the Camino de Santiago. And I asked him every question I could think of. And as I start this next venture of a story, which is this podcast format, I said, man, I want to start with my mom. I got a lot of questions. And we'll see how she does. She is the theatrical one, even though she was kind of against it off the bat. So yeah, we're going to bring her in right here and see how this thing works. Mom, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, nice. So welcome to the podcast. This is the first interview I've ever done on this thing.
All right. I'm glad I'm honored to be a part of this.
How's it sound?
First things
right?
are always the most important things, you know.
Yeah, I heard that.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on. The reason I started with you on this podcast, not sure if you're aware of it, is that this podcast is called Life Without Limits, and it's about people that are charging and going for it, and you know, Maya, your daughter, Ravi, your other son, and myself, I think we all try to do that. And I thought, man, if I'm going to really start this podcast off and get to interview some really cool people about their journey, you know, I want to ask the person that really got to shape my journey. And I did the film with Dad called Life in a Walk that obviously you saw. We'll get to that eventually. But I wanted to dive in with you because you do have this incredible story and spirit about you. And before we dive into the details, I'd love to know, would you categorize yourself as somebody that's always kind of taken chances, risks? Or have you been more passive when you kind of look at your life?
No, I could never say that I was passive.
Yeah, why not?
You know, I think I've been very challenged, and I go for the challenge, but I also have fear. And now that I'm getting older, you know, I'm in a very challenging world, and I notice that I have fear, so I have to always, you know, get rid of that fear to move ahead.
What do you have fears of?
Well, no, just ridiculous things, you know, not like big, huge reality things, just, you know, you're getting older, you don't have, like, another 99 years to go to really shape the future. You know, you got to take it day by day, and, you know, I have to be very mindful to be in the day or in the moment, and that way I get what I want to do, and I don't worry about the fear. But the minute I get ahead of myself, like worrying about whatever's going on with, you know, all of you or whatever's going on in the world, I have no control, but that's where the fear comes in, and that's why I have to stay in the moment and just be challenged with what I'm doing, which is challenging.
So, you know, you grew up in a unique environment overseas. What was it like where you grew up? Tell everybody where you grew up and what your early childhood was like.
Well, I was born in Israel like a year after it became Israel from Palestine, and it was right where Zionism was a big deal for all the Holocaust surviving people. And I come from, as you know, your grandparents were Holocaust survivors. So after losing everything, they decided they would go to the land of Israel, where I was then born. They took the men. My father was in the army. He was in the Haganah. And my mother raised me in a little tiny kind of, I remember it as two rooms. One room, she had two renters. They were also Holocaust survivors, just to make money. One was Uncle Reuben. He had one arm and one was Uncle Zisha. No, one was Uncle Zisha. He had one arm and one was, we called him Uncle Reuben. He had one leg. And they lived in one room and then we lived in another, and my father would come home on the weekends. But what I remember beautifully is holding my mother's hand and going to pick poppies on a hill. And this was in Haifa, which is a seaport town. And, you know, I was little, but poppies only last for one day, and she was very into flowers. So it was really, as I remember it, I even remember just, you know, the hand thing and how beautiful it was to just pick. And you really had nothing because there weren't refrigerators or washers. I mean, there wasn't nothing. The country was just begun. It was basically just desert, so you'd have to go and get ice down the street. I remember playing with a door and getting my nose caught, you know, inside the door because I was very curious. But I remember it as a really special little early time. And then anyone that wanted to leave Israel had to have a sponsor, like a family member that would come through for them, and you only had three choices. You either had the money, which who had the money then? No one. You had a relative that opted for you immediately, but it was the Red Cross that would find them, and in those days the mail wasn't the same. It would take years. Or, you know, you had an immediate sponsor, and your choices were either to come to the United States of America, Argentina, or Canada. We wanted to come to the United States of America, so we went to the last of what we called the refugee camps in a little town called Wolfratshausen in Germany, like near Munich, which was like a civilized little place where maybe 2,000 families, you know, refugees wanted to go somewhere else, lived. And I lived there for 3 years with my parents, so I went to first grade, kindergarten, and came to America when I was 7, starting second grade, and I remember that all very clearly.
Wow. So let's stay over there. What's it like when you're, and before you get to the refugee camp, you know, and what's your dad doing every day? Like when he comes home from work, do you say, "Hey, Dad, how was your day? You know, what did you do at the office? You know, what can you recall from that?"
From my father, you mean back in Israel?
Yeah, when you were back there,
He would come on the weekends. You know, he would just come home. I remember just hanging out, nothing big. It was still survival, you know, making sure that you had food and all was well. You know, he was very happy just serving in the army for whatever level he was serving. But remember, he was already older in his, like, maybe older 30s, because when we came to America, I remember he was 40. So we're talking your age, really, 35, 37, something like that. It wasn't about an office. You know, it was just about survival, really.
What was it like? When did you know about your parents being Holocaust survivors, and how did they share their story with you? Because I remember it as a kid, you know, hearing bits and pieces of it and sitting in their dining room in Scranton, Pennsylvania, across the table, asking questions, but to be the, you know, their immediate child. When did you know it, and how did you learn it?
I think I learned it probably from the beginning, because when we had these two people live in this two-room house or hut or apartment, I'd ask them every day, "Why do you only have one arm, and why do you only have one leg?" You know, and they would explain that, you know, they were involved in a war. And it was, you know, and that's how they lost their arm and their leg. And then they would tell me to please not bother them, but every day I asked them anyway. So, you know, I knew then that something else was different. And then in this refugee camp, you know, growing up in a place from, you know, for 3 years, those are those early, early years, you know, 4 until 7. Everyone else had all these stories, and everyone in this refugee camp in Wolfratshausen had a job to do, like whether you cooked in the kitchen or whatever you were. And, of course, your grandfather was president of the community, which meant that everybody came over. And they would drink schnapps and laugh a lot and talk about their experiences. and how they survived. And all my friends were little children, first generation of survivors. You know, they would talk about, and I would talk about the nightmares they would have. Like, the, you know, you lived in a tiny little room, so they'd be screaming in the middle of the night, and I'd be like, what's going on, you know?
Did
so
you
I learned
them?
About it in a very, 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 very young age. But it wasn't lousy or anything. I mean, it was, they were right there. And they were just praying for my mother more than my father, because he, you know, she had her half-sister, they're called half, they called them, they weren't stepsisters, they were like half-sisters because they came from the same father, but a different mother that were like 20 years older than her that had come to America in the 20s. And she was just waiting to be free and go to this country called America where, you know, nobody was going to kill you if you were a Jew, let alone anything else. So that was her journey. And we were all involved in that.
So how did you learn of your parents' specific stories, and can you share them of what they went through in the Holocaust?
Well, it's really long and lengthy, but they talk about it all the time. You know, you'd sit down and every day there'd be some little vignette of some sort or another, but to keep it short and simple, they both came from different parts of Poland. My mother was 14 when Hitler had come into her village, Hitler's people. And the way that the story was told was her father was the head rabbi of the little tiny community and the mail office supervisor. And she was coming home from school one day, and her teacher said, you can't go home. Your parents have been murdered. They were axed to death. And now you will be a little girl with a different identity named Anna, and you will live with this older family in the mountains of some village in Poland. And anything that you remember as a Orthodox Jewish little girl, you're going to have to forget, because you're going to be their maid. So, for example, my mother tells this amazing story where she watched her father be like a butcher. And in those days, and Orthodox Jews even today, they say a prayer when they slaughter an animal to eat, like a chicken. And the whole idea is to make sure that the animal doesn't suffer. So it has to be a clean cut, but you have to say a blessing. And she said the hardest thing for her was when these older people who were like 40 years older than her that were Polish, would ask her to get a chicken for them for their dinner, she was always very nervous, thinking they were watching her, because she thought for sure they knew that she was a Jew, but she was helping them, so maybe they'd be quiet. And she'd have to not do the prayer, but she'd have to do the slaughter in a very clean-cut way. So that was the hardest thing in the world for her. And my father was lost everyone in the concentration camps. He himself was taken, but he was a fighter from the very bottom of everything and ran away, escaped, and then became a partisan, which was an underground worker in the forest. And he told you all those stories. Plus, I think he also talked to you about being a famous soccer player, but God only knows how he was a famous soccer player with the Holocaust going on. So, you know, but he tells this great story where he saved his brother in the forest, and then when he was shot, he was bleeding heavily from his shoulder, and he was very proud of his wound. If you can just imagine, it was like the greatest medal on earth for him, because he knocked on a woman's door who was a Polish woman, and she treated it with urine. And not because he was a Jew or anyone else. He said the compassion that she showed him was just something that he never wanted to forget. As long as he lived, he wanted to give that back. And so he spent all those couple of years being an underground fighter and stealing whatever he could steal from others to give to the poor. And then when we came to America, he taught me magnificent lessons that shaped who I am today. Like, for example, we came to America in 1956. So I was 7, and I think 5 years later they bought their first house. And he bought a little grocery store. And it was like a mom-and-pop store, if they even have those today, I don't even know. But anyway, he hired a man named Henry, a painter. But Henry only had one leg and one arm. Kind of reminded me of Uncle Zisha and Uncle Reuven. So I said to him one day, in a very serious fashion, "Dad, I don't understand how you hired Henry, because this is like a huge house. It's going to take him forever to paint with one arm and one leg, just going up and down a ladder with paint and not having any help. I don't know why you hired him." And he just looked at me in the most deepest way and said, "Devorah Lev," which is little Devorah, "if I don't hire Henry," quote, and I'll never forget this, and I'm going to quote it for you, "if I don't hire Henry, who will?" So that was my big lesson into kindness for others and no judgment. But that doesn't mean that I was the greatest non-judger in the universe. But, you know, he put me in my places many times, as did my mother when it came to, you know, like they had this little store, and it was in the heart of what then was called the red light district, where there were drugs and a lot of alcoholics and all kinds of prostitution. But they would get, the different people would get their welfare checks, and they would come to his store to buy milk and food for their kids. But he knew, and so did she, my mother, that some of these family members would go to the bar next door and spend it all. So we had them deposit the check with him so that there would be food enough for their families. And even if they didn't have the money, he'd give the food away anyway, you know. So that was a lesson to be learned also for me.
How about, you know,
non-judgment?
He had a previous wife and a child. Did he ever talk to you about them and what happened?
Yeah, he did. Let's see. After the war, he married a woman and they had a child, and he was like a business guy and he was out of town for the weekend or something like that. And I believe it happened in a little town called Kelts. It was like a pogrom that happened after the war was over. And a bunch of Poles, I think, stormed the village and wanted to. He lived on the outskirts of the village, so he was away. They robbed his house, and murdered his wife and child, which was maybe 6 weeks old, and another family that lived more in town. And when he came back and saw that, he knew he had to leave Poland, and he got on a train. He said he was a train wreck himself, and out of the blue, he meets my mother going on the same train, you know, leaving Poland. And they both got to talking, and they were going to a similar place, and then got there and dated and ended up together.
That's crazy, though. Like, I mean, did you think about that when you were a child or a teenager about how they met? Maybe, I mean, who knows why they met and what the world wanted them, you know, why the world wanted them to connect. But that's like stuff out of Hollywood, right?
Right. Well, it's more than Hollywood. It's higher power or very godlike, you know. It's just being in the right place at the right time for the right moment, or look at the Holocaust, being in the wrong place at the wrong time for the wrongest moments, you know.
When you were a kid and you'd hear those stories in the refugee camp about survivors, what did you feel? Were you angry? Were you sympathetic?
No, I think as a child they tried to keep it simple for us kids. We would, as I said, go to school, you know, have lunch. We would hear the stories, but we were still children that played like other children. You know, there was a ball. There was a courtyard. There was a little park. Their memories they kept alive by sharing their stories, but the children was their hope for the future. I mean, that was a whole other thing for every one of them. So they wanted life to be, you know, beautiful for us, not ravaged and full of losses like it was for them. My memory takes me there at this moment. You know, it's sitting around a big table. I even have a little picture of it, of me with little braids and a little ring I had on my finger that they bought me, having a birthday party for another child in the classroom. You know, I mean, life was, they tried to make life normal for the future.
When you're in
so
a
it wasn't
refugee
the sadness,
camp.
You know, for children. I didn't
right.
mean to interrupt.
I mean,
what?
We're going to get to that. But I'd love to know, like, I'm trying to think back to when I'm 5, 6, 7 years old, right? And you're in this
uh-huh.
refugee camp. I get it. You're playing. You're a kid. But were you thinking, like, okay, well, we might end up in Argentina. We might end up in the U.S. Like, did you even, like, what did you even picture in those other places? Because clearly, I'm assuming everybody's kind of waiting for their number to be called and
right.
to get sent towards the boat that they're going to go on.
Right. I had no idea, really. I just knew that the way that my mother talked about it, it was just going to be this other kind of place where people are free and they don't have to worry about their religion or what they think. They could read a newspaper and they don't have to look over their shoulders. They don't have to have any fear. And I couldn't even imagine what she was talking about. And when we went on a boat, a big ship, a boat, it was huge, and then came to New York, all I remember was holding their both hands. We had nothing, carrying a few things from Germany. That are just little treasures that I still have, and just looking up and seeing the tallest buildings in the world and getting on a train to meet up with our relatives. And this woman was sitting, she was a bigger woman, she was sitting on this train, and she was eating this food that I'd never seen in my life. And as I got up from where we were sitting, I went over to her, and she knew I was a little refugee because you should have seen my costume.
What?
little bloomers, little pants with a little matching jacket and all these, you know, very stylish socks. So that's why I'm still a sock fanatic. They have to be cool. And a little matching hat. I mean, they must have spent a fortune on that just to look right. But oddly enough, you know, you were like the little immigrant. Anyway, this woman was eating a banana and a pear. I'll never forget it. I just stared at her because I didn't know any English, and she read my language, which meant, you know, what are you eating? So she didn't give me anything. She held up this yellow thing, and she said, banana, and then held up a green thing and said, pear. And to this day, I have to tell you that they're probably the most sacred fruits that we have here in this house. You know?
Wow.
Yeah, even if I, you know. So then my mother said, you know, she cautioned me to come over, and I just kept repeating, banana, pear, banana, pear.
Oh,
and my mother said,
that's cute.
What? You know, vos is dus in Yiddish. But that was a memory. But then, you know, we come to Scranton, Pennsylvania, and we live with Aunt Jenny, who's like 30 years older than my mother, I think, or close to that. And it was just such a different life until we got our own apartment, because that took like a month or 3 weeks.
When you got to the U.S., what were some of your initial thoughts? And what's like the first day of school like? You know, and what time of year did you even get there? You know, do you have a summer
well,
to take an English lesson?
Well, we came to America on, I think it was April 7th, something like that. And I have to tell you, if it wasn't April 7th, it was definitely close to April 7th, because it was the day they said that Grace Kelly got married. You know, on the loudspeaker, it was a big announcement, and I have a really good ear, you know, in terms of hearing, and even though it was a different language. So this famous actress gets married that day, and we come to America that day, you know. I'd never seen a TV. I'd never seen a vacuum cleaner, and Aunt Jenny's house, those were the most amazing things that I ever saw in my life, because I could not understand the cord that you plug into a wall, how that worked. Or even a huge refrigerator. Like, life just wasn't that way where we lived, you know. So that's at 7, it was like, wow, you know.
So what's school like for you? I mean,
well,
bullying going on?
Well, they decided to send
or?
Me to, huh?
Like, what? Yeah, what's school like? Is it hard, easy? Are you getting bullied? Are you easy friends?
No, I went, my parents wanted me to go to, like, a Hebrew day school with other Jewish kids. And I remember, you know, leaving early in the morning and walking up five blocks and going to school. I had, like, pigtails, and by the time I got to school, I was a mess. I jump into all the puddles and things of that nature. They would give you all these stories about religion, and I'd always raise my hand and ask questions. And one day in third grade, I remember this. I mean, the classes had like maybe eight or nine kids in them, men and women, boys and girls. And then when you were puberty in seventh grade, you were separated because, you know, if a girl had gotten her period, she couldn't be near a male. But I remember this one teacher that we had said that there's a major difference between Jews and non-Jews. And he said that the way you could tell a Jewish person from a non-Jewish person was that you have an indentation in your upper lip. And I'm like, what? So on my way home from school, because I had to meet my cousin Datsy, who went to like a bigger school two blocks away, I asked everybody if they were Jewish or they weren't, and I noticed everybody had the same thing. I was incensed. I remember this as a fact, because the next day I got there early and I had my hand raised immediately when school started, and I said, Rabbi, you lied, and I don't understand why you lied to us. And he said, what? And then I told him, you know, I had asked everybody, and everybody had the same face, and that does not make a Jew. And he threw me to the wolves. I spent the rest of my life with the principal at the piano singing songs.
Why?
Most of the time. Because he just, you know, I was just such a questioner of things, which is why I was a philosophy major later in life. What now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm interested. I mean, you said off the top of this podcast, you talked about fear, and mm-hmm. then clearly as a child, like, it seemed like you were pretty fearless as you
right.
venture from a town to a refugee camp to a new country. Where did that come from, and was it embedded by your parents, do you think?
I think I've been a little blessed free spirit. You know, I think the fear thing that I started with is just from getting older, because, and now I'm 67, and now you're talking to me about 60 years ago, you know, that I can remember like it was a second ago.
Wow.
And I think at 67, you know, you want, you know, you just want to be around for a long time, because, you know, you there's just a lot to do in the world in terms of challenges and working and learning about being kinder and softer and, you know, having grandchildren and waiting for my two lovely sons to find, you know, a compassionate, significant other. And, you know, when you get ahead of that road where you're suddenly 67 and you know, you'd be lucky to have another 10 good years, and having your friends die that are either your age or even younger, you know, you get scared. And that's where that fear entered. But as a child growing up and, you know, learning how to survive, that was embedded by my family and just me watching them. Because look at all the languages I knew. Hebrew, Yiddish. I could understand Polish, although they thought I couldn't, because when they didn't want me to understand anything, they would speak that. And a famous saying that they used to always say stuck in my brain, which goes like this. I'm going to say it in Polish because I think the world needs to hear it. It's the greatest saying ever. It goes like this. Jak się nie ma, co czym lubić, co czym lubić, co czym ma. And what it means is, if you don't get what you like, you have to like what you get. That was like an adage in my house, you know, growing up.
Wow.
And I would always try to, you know, rebel against that. Because, you know, as an immigrant, when I see the images of refugees now, people on boats, people, adults with their children on a boat, holding onto them for dear life, or seeing blood everywhere that the images are on the TV screen today. My memory is very different for me because I had these two parents that held on to me. You know, I remember the hands. You know, I remember holding their hands and them holding mine back. And it wasn't like it is now. I mean, you were actually in a safe camp waiting for the next moment of your life to begin, you know. It wasn't like having to climb over fences and take little boats and go through horrible waters just to get to the other side. You know, it's different.
What was high school like for you?
It was okay. It was big. It was lots of people. I really didn't care about a lot of things. I liked very few things, being in theater, art, literature, and you know, language classes. But, you know, it was social. I didn't really connect to all groups. I hung out with different groups. Drugs didn't come into that world in the middle 60s. High school, your father and I graduated in 1967. Kids would be drinking, but I wasn't a part of that scene. Vietnam was happening. And, you know, I went in that direction of being against things and fighting for things and going to college. And I decided the Six-Day War broke out in the Middle East. And after leaving Judaism for a while because of this ridiculousness that I thought they spoke about, which was, you know, a lot of hypocrisy, the Six-Day War broke out, and I wanted to experience Israel all over again, so I went there as a volunteer. And I lived on a kibbutz, and I think I got re-in touch with, you know, fighting for a country and remembering how, you know, my parents were there fighting for Zionism and having a safe place, and still it wasn't safe. But I felt like it was just an amazing beginning for me on my journey. Getting up really early in the morning and, you know, picking bananas or apples for 8 hours a day and living with all kinds of people from all kinds of countries, let alone the people that were, you know, in these political systems, because every kibbutz was built then on different political systems. And I was in a very liberal one.
So you're 18 when you go back over there?
Yeah, 18. Yeah, 18. And then I was drafted by the Israeli army because I'm an Israeli, but I'm an American citizen. So I have dual citizenship, and the last thing I was going to do was be going to the Israeli army. So I left Israel, and I came back and started my journey in going to college, and eventually ended up, your father and I got married in 1971, and we were at Syracuse University, and I ended up getting my BA there. And then we left Syracuse. Dad got his first job in a hospital in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, so that lasted about a year and a half. And then he got another job in the Wilkes-Barre area, and that we moved there as a social worker. And then after 7 years of marriage, we decided maybe it would be time to have a family, although I was scared to death because I thought I'd be the worst mother with my temper, let alone, you know, my patience. And magic started to happen. You know, we had Maya, then, of course, then the twins that I lost, and then came Miracle You, and then Miracle Ravi. And then we moved to Dalton, where you grew up. After you were two, we got here when you were about two and a half, and you know, we've lived here ever since. Dad got transferred to a job, and I fell in love with art therapy because it just happened by accident that someone had asked me to work with these kids that had trauma because they were in a car accident and they couldn't do anything. And at that time, I was in, like, all the expressive arts, movement therapy, and just, you know, I was doing a little bit of therapy in the evening with different people that would come here, because Dad, you know, was a master's in social work. And I went, anyway, when I went to this office to meet these teenage kids, there happened to be some crayons there and some paper, and just intuitively, I said, if you can't remember anything, why don't you just draw me a picture of something that happened to you? And it was magic. It was amazing. And I knew that that's what I wanted to do. So I called around and found that there was Marywood College then, and they had just started their art therapy program, got in, and every day your dad would go to work. The minute he'd come home, I'd be gone to class for 3 hours, 6 to 9, and then I'd come home, and, you know, that's how it went for like 7.5 years.
I want to go back to the, I want to go back to the to the 6 day war. I want to know what it's like when you tell your parents, you tell your boyfriend at the time, and just graduate high school, and what's their response to, okay, yeah, go for it? Or did they
push back? They thought when the 6 day war happened in June, they thought it would be really great for me to be a volunteer there, because I could have gone down a road where, you know, I wasn't sure what I wanted to major in. I would have just gone to a local college maybe, or, you know, somewhere else. Nothing was in stone, because I told them I wanted to travel the world after high school for a year. And they thought I was insane. Travel the world? What are you going to do for money? And what world, you know? There's a 6 day war happening in this country. Why don't you think about going there if you want to travel somewhere for a year? So they were very supportive of that.
How about Dad? You know, when you tell your boyfriend that, what did he say? Did he want to come?
He did.
You know?
Well, we were just, you know, dating then. No, he didn't care what I was doing. You know, I mean, he thought it was great. Why would I run my life past, you know, with a boyfriend that I didn't even know, you know? That was not going to be my determinator of, you know, living at that time. Because we had just met in May, and shit, it was June. And I think I left in August, you know, by the time I got all my paperwork and citizenship papers and quite the production. So
a lot of people have who are listening may have watched Life on a Walk. And a lot of great feedback is about the story about you and Dad. Well, in your perspective, how do you remember meeting him, and how did you two end up falling in love with one another?
Well, for me, I have to tell you, I was madly in love with him from that first moment.
Which was when?
We met in some parking lot to go to some birthday party, and we just could not stop talking the entire night. I mean, it wasn't about sex, and it wasn't about alcohol. It just was this amazing connection. Like a soul connection. And then it was so cool, because even in the film, in those days, you know, you had a landline phone and you had a phone book, and that's how you looked up numbers. And normal, I mean, I did do a bit of the dating scene, and normal people would just ask for your telephone number. But no one ever said, what's your father's name? You know, so I could look it up. I mean, he didn't have to say that part. I knew that. And I just thought that was very special.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So you guys decide to have kids.
After we were married for like 7 years.
Yeah. Huh? You know, what's that like to, you know, watch your first child come into the world, right? It's Maya. And of course, I need to ask, how did you name her, me, and Ravi? Like, where do these things come from?
Oh my God, because your father and I are insane. We, you know, I wanted to keep the Hebrew culture alive and well, but I didn't want to push Judaism down your throats. But you had grandparents that, you know, went through so much and loved tradition and ritual, and, you know, we were there for all holidays. And your father was in love with Buddhism, and you know, we were part of the yoga thing then. You know, we learned about all that. So he picked I picked a Hebrew name, and he picked a Buddhist name. And then, this is true, I thought Maya was going to be a little boy named Ariel with little red sneakers when she would come out into the world. And I was completely shocked that she was a little girl. And I knew that the name had to be like Ariel somewhere, because that was a name that meant lion. So we flipped a coin, and her name, and Dad had picked this name Maya, which is a magnificent dream or a magnificent nightmare.
For a girl?
So we flipped a coin for a girl.
Okay.
And so his coin flipped to Maya being the first name, and then rather than keep it Ariel, we made it Ariella, and that's how she got the name Maya Ariella. Same thing with you. I love the name Zohar.
Ariel.
Huh?
Do you think I'm going to be Ariel?
Ariel is the male version of Ariella.
I know.
So the female lioness. Then when it was your turn, I fell in love with this name Zohar. And, of course, he loved the name Yogi. And, again, we flipped a coin, so it was Yogi Zohar, you know.
And what do those mean?
You don't know what your name means?
I do, but I think that the listener might be curious. I want to hear from your voice.
Well, Yogi would be Union of Splendor, which is Zohar. I mean, but splendor in its deepest fashion.
Okay. And then how about Ravi?
Because there's like a book of mysticism. It wasn't about Yogi the Mystic. Like, there isn't any of that bullshit. It's just this deep name. And then with Ravi, it was the same thing. I like the name Ravi as a great teacher, and Rambam was this great rabbi that was just beautiful in his literary form as he preached whatever he preached. So we flipped a coin, and Rambam Ravi didn't quite sound right, so it became Ravi Rambam.
What
and
was
that's
it like
how he
to
got his name.
What was it like to lose a set of twins? I asked Dad that,
oh,
but
it was
I never
a nightmare.
Asked you.
First of all, from the minute of my pregnancy, I felt weird because Maya was like carrying around a little football, and same with you and Ravi. But the twins, that was just like enormous from the beginning. And I just felt something was off. And, you know, the doctor that we had then, because Dad delivered all of you, it was like, you know, you walked into a room in a hospital in case something went wrong, but everything was very natural. When I was about almost in the seventh month, I started to bleed. So when I called the doctor, he said, well, you're probably having a miscarriage, so come into the hospital. And as we drove, we lived about a half an hour away, I just figured, all right, so I'm going to lose this baby. And that's almost the seventh month. But when I came in, not only did I lose the baby, I was ready to get up and go. And they said, no, 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 there's another one. So I had no idea that I was carrying twins, even though I was convinced my pregnancy was weird. To make a very long, intense journey short, I had to spend the night in the, neonatal unit where all the babies were screaming and crying, and here I am bleeding to death. And my doctor coming to me and saying he was so sorry. I mean, it was one of the most horrific moments of my life. I kind of backed off of all activity and civilization, and we lived in a little town called Hobby, which was in the middle of nowhere, with a stream and woods and Maya, and I just spent a month recovering and just being with her. And then about a year later, you were conceived, and I was a nervous wreck. And you were born in the eighth month, and then I came from two, meaning my brother and I, so we wanted three, and Dad came from four, so we thought we'd try for one more. And I was about 34, and then was able to conceive Ravi, and he also was born in the eighth month, but all of you were normal and nothing wrong.
How did you deal
with that? Because of losing the twins, I was a wreck. Huh?
Yeah. How did you process that? I mean, people go through terrible things in life a lot, and I believe you either come out better for it or it can really eat you up. You know, what was your process like to go through that?
Well, back to the great tradition called Judaism, you had to name them, even though they were the first, was a stillborn, and what had happened was that the second was like a pound bigger. They were playing, I guess, in the womb, and one had scrunched the first leg. So the first one's name was Raphael, and the second one's name was Zeke, and you had to bury them with a funeral. And, you know, a marker in, on a particular grave. Not that it says anything other than just, you know, whatever that is. So that was one process. And the other was, what was I going to do? I mean, I had a little girl that was very busy. And, you know, I had to let it go and be grateful that nothing happened to me, that I was still alive and well, and that I was still young enough to conceive more if Dad and I so chose to. So
where were they
buried? I took that time off and moved on.
Where were they buried?
They're buried in some cemetery somewhere in Wilkes-Barre. It doesn't say like Roth babies or anything. I think it just has a marker because it was just a part of the traditional ritual. But
you know,
I do remember telling the doctor in the hospital room to please not put them in a paper bag. In a plastic bag. I wanted to see them, and they thought I was out of my mind, you know. But they were beautiful, perfect. One was 1.5 pounds, and one was 2.5 pounds, and they didn't open their eyes. But when I delivered the second one, the doctor asked if I wanted that child whisked to some hospital, but the brain damage would be enormous, and I said no. You know.
Right. I know that you, you've always talked about mindfulness and TikTok on, and you know, I know in his story, he talks about, intention. You know, and you can set an intention and say, for instance, I want to have a child. I want to have a child. I want to have a child. And if the child's not ready to come, then it's not going to. And he tells this story in one of his books where the child before him was also a miscarriage and passed away. But he had always felt a connection to that sibling. And as the child after both Raphael and Zeke, in some weird way, I've always felt a crazy connection to those two guys. And I don't know what that is, but I've never shared that with anybody, but I always have.
I wish that I had discovered Thich Nhat Hanh then, because he would have made my journey of recovery and health much simpler than it was, because I felt like such a murderer after that. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to anyone hearing this, probably, but you know, I couldn't get into the what-ifs at all. And he says that, you know, when you're born, or even just in your life, as you're walking, like you and Dad took this walk, you walk for yourself, but you walk for others. And what he says that's even more beautiful than all even that is you walk for those who can't walk, and you walk for the past people that walked that couldn't walk, and you walk for the future. People that haven't been here yet, you walk for them. So it's really a full circle, because he thinks that, from my understanding of him and all the years that I've read him in the last 10 years or so, that everything is connected.
Right.
And it's true. It is. So whatever connection that you have to these two that you have never known, is there, you know.
I'd love to jump ahead. You know, you got three kids, and I can remember growing up in a household where two things really went down. Let's explore the first one. One is that if I came home with a poor grade, I remember getting in trouble, but it wasn't because I didn't have an A. It was because, Yogi, you live in America, and you better take advantage of that. Was that something that you, like, how did you get that across? I don't remember I don't remember a lot other than that mindset. And I'm just curious, you know, look, hey, I obviously, as you know, I don't have any kids, but I think myself and a lot of these listeners who maybe have met your children or just in general, you're curious, but how did you raise kids with that mindset?
Well, first of all, I have to say I was so fortunate to have such a good man like your dad with me raising all of you, because when we decided it was time to have kids, there was no time for any of this other bullshit. You know, the world of drugs and alcohol was out. Not that we were drug addicts or alcoholics, but whatever we knew, we wanted to make sure our kids knew. And coming from such a fractured place that my parents came from and working so hard just to understand all these cultures that I experienced before the age of 7, there wasn't time to screw around. I mean, you know, I had so much work to do as an immigrant, because you have no idea how lucky you have it being an American. You grew up in a free country. You were able to read a book. You learned language. You didn't have to suffer on learning something or understanding a concept. Like for me, stupid things like dawn and sunrise. What's the big deal that is such a different thing? But as an immigrant and learning language, English is very complicated, because for the same word you have thousands of adjectives. And you have to work so much harder than the person that was graced to be born here, no matter what anyone says. I will, if anyone disagrees with me, we'll have a long, lengthy conversation. Like, I knew nothing about fairy tales until Maya was born, really, or what I might have picked up, you know, with theater and things along the way. But how was I going to read her a book about fairy tales if I didn't know fairy tales? So we'd go to the bookstore, and I read every damn book on fairy tales you can imagine, and that's how I learned how to, you know about fairy tales. But I didn't have that in my childhood experience. So when you came home thinking science wasn't going to be great, I had to be very creative with you, and the only creative way that you would hear me was with T-shirts. So do you remember I said, well, Yoga, I'm going shopping today, and I saw the coolest T-shirt. Now I need to know, as you're walking out the door, I don't know if you remember this, I said, my big question to you is, should I get uppercase or lowercase letters that says, Yogi loves science, or Yogi loves math? And you just stared at me and walked out the door and said, never mind. Yeah. Like, you'd go to Dad with these questions, and he'd say, now, son, knowledge is no burden to carry, and all these things that you've been talking about for, you know, all of your life lately. But, you know, I kept it very simple. It was either going to be uppercase or lowercase, and you knew that I would do that. You knew that.
How about, you know, I know as kids, you know, we didn't have
because
it hard.
Because I'm insane. What?
You're not insane. But I know as a family, you know, we didn't have it hard, but we didn't have everything given to us.
No. No,
I do
and we
remember.
Would never have given it to you either, even if we
no.
had it.
I'm not surprised. But I always am curious about, you know, all three of your children love to travel and explore. Clearly, you're someone who was born across the ocean. Our dad is the most well-read guy I've ever met. But to me, I was always fascinated that you had foreign exchange students come to our house, because we couldn't
right.
go to Germany or Paris or wherever on some dramatic, you know, luxurious vacation. It seemed like you brought them to
right.
us.
We did.
I say that now at 34. Was that the idea behind that?
Well, the idea behind it was, we didn't want you to just grow up living in this tiny little town of Dalton, Pennsylvania, thinking that life was just about, you know, going to high school and playing sports or being a musician or being a theater person, like your sister and your brother took off in those directions more than athletics. You took off in the athletic direction. So Dad was a social worker then, and different students from around the world would come to this area for 6 weeks, and somebody had to put them up. So we wanted you to experience as many cultures as possible in your early years. So that's why we had someone always living here every year for, I think, 6 years we did that, from different countries. So I remember the first one was from Denmark. know, then we had someone from China. We had someone from India. We had someone, we had Sven from Sweden that ended it. We had a guy from Israel as well. And then we had somebody from the Western Indies who loved to iron. And I didn't even have an iron then, but I went out and got an iron and an ironing board. Because we really wanted you to have culture, you know, beyond just what we were able to provide for you from our rich heritage of our parents and extended family members. So that's why we did
that. Like, Mama, how do you see that working? Like, I remember as a kid, all those people being there, but I also remember wanting to go play basketball and wishing one of them had a jump shot. But you and Dad had this idea or this knowledge, okay, this is going to seep into these kids' subconscious. Or maybe you had a different idea, but did you see it working, and how did you see that working?
Well, just the idea that someone came into this house of a different ethnicity and would tell you stories about their lives. Like the first woman we had from Denmark smoked incredible amounts of cigarettes and knit sweaters at the same time. She knit each one of you a sweater in like 2 days and was so proud of giving it to you. And remember, our winters were really harsh here. And they were very colorful. And you guys were just shocked that, you know, A, somebody could knit a sweater in 2 days, let alone wear it, you know. Which you wore yours a lot.
I'm sure. I think that's really cool. I'm curious how, you know, you had Maya. She was, you could all call her the musician, obviously ridiculously smart. Now she's a PhD, crushing it. Younger brother, Ravi, he was the performer, the actor. I was the jock. For somebody that didn't grow up around a lot of that, right, as you referenced, you didn't grow up around a lot of the plays that exist. You didn't grow up around maybe a lot of the things that your daughter was doing. You definitely didn't grow up around football. What was that like for you to watch us get on those paths?
Oh, it's
and for
magic.
Me, I saw you become an expert in football. You went from not knowing anything to I call
right.
you coach.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, the child is the father of the man. There's an old expression, an old saying, and it's true. You guys taught your father and I everything. From the way that you understood the world to the way that you grasped things before you even spoke, you know, just all of your mannerisms, for each of you, you each taught us things, and we just had to remember to be on the same page, which is if it's no from me, it's no from him, it's no. It's not like you guys were going to play us against each other. You know, we had the same response. Even though we worked with each of you differently based on what we both, each of us knew in our own talents or whatever we knew, we were on the same page regarding discipline. And, you know, if you're going to start something, you have to finish it honorably, you know, all those things. Even though that had nothing to do with my life growing up or even your dad's necessarily, it was just a philosophy that we both felt was really important in children growing up in the world that you grew up in, which is very different than the world of children growing up in today's world. Because
today's world, I
would die if you had a cell phone right now. If you were growing up, can you imagine knowing everything you did? Not that you did anything majorly wrong, but knowing the way the world is right now and going to high school and each of you having a cell phone, how the hell would I know who you're talking to, you know? And that kind of craziness is just insane, going
but
back to
going
the way
anywhere.
That you grew up. Hmm?
No, so
I mean,
that,
we had a landline phone,
right.
And if Maya didn't get off the phone, I would threaten to cut the wires. I'd have to show up in her room and with the scissors, you know?
But, you know, there's a lot of parents listening to this, new parents, and if you were to do it now, you know, how would you raise kids, knowing what we're exposed to, knowing that everybody needs to get a trophy to a large degree, knowing that the competitive grit isn't necessarily what it was when I was a kid?
Oh, I would do it the same way, but I would definitely be very controlling on the cell phone and internet use. You know, I would have to know what you're doing. I'd have to be on top of it.
How did you create discipline for us? Because I think anybody who meets you knows that you're a badass and you're tough. You know, how did you create that with
us?
I think all of us are that way.
I didn't grow up with parents being on the same page, you know, in terms of, no, you can't go out, or yeah, you can. I kind of ran the show myself most of the time until I got in a jam. And I didn't want that for my family, ever. Like, I couldn't control, like, what religion you wanted to pick necessarily, because I didn't want to throw anything down your throats. We're vegetarians. I could control that, because Dad and I decided we would be vegetarians and wanted that kind of a life for all of you in that healthy fashion. We both were instrumental in raising all of you with discipline, because that's what you need to have, whether it's today's world or 100 years ago. You know, you need to finish things. You need to commit to things. You need to, you know, you pick it, but see it through.
When I told you that I wanted to walk on, and for those that don't know what that means go to a college without a scholarship and basically try out for the football team. What did you think? You know, were you of the mindset of a parent of, oh, I got to protect my kid. I don't know. He might not make it.
No.
I don't know what the heck this is.
No,
or
absolutely not. I was just waiting for you to decide where you're going and let me know already. No, I was very convinced that no matter where you went and whatever you wanted to do, you would be successful because of all the hard work that you do for everything. I
but when
no
you
doubt.
Saw me, when you knew I went to Pitt and I was going to go play football there with guys faster, bigger, stronger, were you? Oh man, I don't know if he's going to make it. Oh, he's totally going. I mean, where were you at?
I was convinced that you were going to make it just fine. I just didn't want you getting killed.
Right.
You know?
What's that like to watch a kid? I mean, I broke my neck playing. You know, when you saw that my sophomore year, when you're a parent from the stands, what's that experience like for you?
That was the worst thing I ever saw, because it was at the game at Pittsburgh, and I hate South Florida from that moment forth. Wasn't it South Florida?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, every time they're on TV, I always root that they would lose. That was probably the worst thing that I could ever see from a booth, because we were with Michelle then, watching you get hit. And I didn't know that you had a neck injury at that time. You were very quiet about what exactly it was. I didn't know that your neck was killing you until you went to, USC, and then you had surgery.
You know, I always remember.
Huh? Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I always remember, growing up and you guys saying, hey, look, when you're 18, like, you got to go. You got to go figure it out. And
I said it way before then. I said,
right.
See these birds? This is the nest. You're here until you're 18. Then you pick a college and you go there. And you're always welcome to come home for a visit. But you will not be here, because what's
Why
here is nothing. This is where you grew up. You've got to go out into the world and make something of yourself somewhere in the world. And that was how we raised you, that you just can't live in the same nest.
But so often in, like, other cultures around the world that you've seen or I've seen, families live in the same village, the same hut, the same community, and it seemed like we weren't pushed out, but it seemed like you were like, look, there's a huge world out there, man. You got to go. And I don't know if that's just my interpretation or if that was what you guys decided upon.
Well, it wasn't that we decided it, but we said from the very beginning, you're on loan to us, really. God gave us a gift of 3 amazing children, and now you have to give your gift to the world. Wherever you want to go, you can go. We'll educate you. You know, we'll scrimp and save for your college education so that you don't have to pay back enormous loans, and we did that. But if you're going to go out drinking, guess what? You're going to get a job on your college campus and spend your own spending money.
Right.
And you all
right.
did that. You all had jobs. And you all had jobs here. And if we didn't start it when you were little, I mean, you started washing dishes at 12. You know, you needed a car. And we said, if you save your money, we'll pay for half of your car. I mean, all those little stupid things that maybe a lot of kids today don't get really shapes the person that you are. Because even if you grew up in the wealthiest family, I would never give you everything because you have to earn it. You have to work towards it. We would always be there to pick up the pieces as we are still. But you have to go out and earn it. You have to go out and make it on your own. And what's the point of living with mom and dad forever? I mean,
yeah,
really.
It's not that cool. Well, last couple,
I mean, it's cool on a certain level, but, like, you don't have to worry about our health as we grow older. You don't need to worry about, you know, us growing older. I mean, that isn't a job for a child. A job for a child is to just, you know, create something special in this universe.
So last couple for you. Last couple for you. We'll let you go. You've been great, Mom, by the way.
Yeah, I can
imagine.
The Life
Without Limits podcast. We love it. You're killing it. I want to know, because when I was in college and then left college, both of your parents passed away.
Right.
And what's that like for somebody? I mean, clearly, for anyone to lose a parent is traumatic and terrible, but also a part of life. But you saw your parents go through so much. You learned about so many unique elements of their story before you were 7 years old. You watched them give away everything and then get bankrupt in the U.S. You saw them compete and fight and strive, but most importantly, love. And then when they left, I'm curious what that was like for you.
It was very sad. Your grandfather was a fighter to the last second. He was diagnosed with prostate cancer like 20 years before he died of it. But in those days, they didn't really know much. And I think with his nerves, he took Valium to relax during the day. But as it got a hold of him at 82, he just looked at me one day and said he thought he was going to die, and he looked like hell. We went to the doctor. He was supposed to start a chemo treatment. I took him on a wheelchair. He couldn't hardly even walk on a Friday. I did little wheelies with him. We giggled. And then Sunday he became very ill. Monday he went to the hospital. He was, you know, he had a lot of swab. Your grandfather did. I remember him asking the nurses to please be sweet and let him out of the bed. And they said, no, we cannot do that, you know, Morris, as he called himself. And so he resolved to go to the fourth floor. They put him in hospice. The cancer had spread, and he left the planet on Thursday. You know, from a Friday of chemo, not even a week later, he was gone. And it was so sad, not only because he was gone. I mean, he was ready. I can't say he was ready to go, but once they wouldn't let him out of the bed, he knew that that was it. I think the worst part was watching my mother fall apart because he was her caregiver. You know, she had had heart surgery. I don't know if you remember. I think when you were still in high school, because she was only born with three valves, which none of us even knew until then. And they needed to do surgery, and she wouldn't let them touch her until her mother appeared in a dream and said she'd be okay. And she only had X amount of weeks to go. And that was the year from hell. It was the year that I got my master's. You know, Maya was a sophomore in high school, so you were, what, in eighth grade? Robbie was in sixth grade or fifth grade. Finally, her mother appeared in a dream, and she had the heart surgery, but she was never the same after that. I mean, she was the same maybe for you, but with me, she wasn't the same. And when he died, and she was suddenly living by herself, anyone that wore a green jacket outside as she'd look out the window were suddenly the Nazis. So all of those fears that, you know, she had once upon a time, and all the languages that your grandmother knew were many, many different dialects of Russian and Polish, and she was very quick-witted and very linguistic. All of that came back. And finally, I got her into the Jewish home, And, you know, all she wanted to do was get her coat on so she could go home and make dinner for her husband. You know, that was her life, really. And then when she died, it was just the end of, not an era, but just, it took a while. It took a while to sink in. But, you know, the Jewish tradition has this beautiful thing that you could do when someone dies, or the anniversary of their death. There's this candle, they call it a Yahrzeit candle. They have it in other cultures too, in Catholicism and different other religious sects, where you buy a little glass, it's in a glass, and it's just a candle, and it lasts 24 hours, and you put it on your stove or on your counter, and you say a blessing, and you light it, and it lasts a grand total of 24 hours. So you have a certain sense of spirit if you're connected to them, and it's there, and then suddenly 24 hours later it's gone. So that's how we remember the moments, you know, those decisive moments. So your father and I light a candle for his parents and ours, and usually if it's an anniversary of his parents, we'll invite mine, and so on and so forth. So they're the four are together.
I always remember when we leave their home, you know, we go to their house for, whenever we go to your parents' house for a holiday, I can always remember right before we leave, you know, of course, like as a kid, like you hated like getting kissed by your grandparents, but I remember both of them always giving me a kiss on the cheek and always telling me that to make sure that you love in life, you know, life is nothing without love. And I remember that because I think of, they went through the literal hell. I mean, they went through things. I mean, we think a workout's hard or your boss is an asshole. Like, they went through things that we wouldn't dream on anybody. When you look back at that, were they always that way? And what do you think when you hear that from one of your kids? Because that's what they told me. I'm not sure what they told you every day, but every time I left, it was, you know, nothing in life. Life is nothing without love. Literally, every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, they wouldn't tell me that every day because I had quite a variety of friends, you know.
Right.
But they did tell me that if I was going to be in this world, and I'm so lucky to be here, that I was meant to do something special for someone else and never forget that. That
right.
You are not here to just be a self-centered person and everything is just for you. That if you're going to live a full life, you're going to have to be kind to somebody every day of your life. Anybody. And not judge them by virtue of what they look like or whether they have one leg or one arm. You know, the quality of your life from all their lessons, to put it in a nutshell, was such that you always have to be kind to somebody. And that is what your life is really about. It's not about all the money you can make or lose. It's not about all the thousands of wives or husbands you can marry. It's not about all the houses you can have or all the perfections. It's just about helping somebody else and reaching out to somebody, which is really ironic for me now that I'm working in the world of a, you know, drug and alcohol addiction hospital, because I never thought I was so kind until I started this job. And everything they told me is what I see happening for me today. You know, I'm asking a person to please stop walking as I tie their shoes. I mean, it's just coming from my heart. It's not coming from my mind, you know.
What's it like being a grandparent now?
Oh, it's very special. I mean, I'm not like the typical doting grandmother that walks around with her cell phone and all the pictures, and if I see someone I know, oh, let me show you. But I love just hanging out with them. In the silliest ways, you know, imaginable. I love the pre-verbal stage of just, like Wes, the last time I saw him, he was into clicking, like, and me just talking to him that way and giggling. I mean, it's very different than raising your own.
Wow.
And it's just... I can't wait to see it happen for you and for Ravi, you know. It's a magic that's unique all unto itself, because that's another thing where you're hoping that you have some time on the planet so they get to know you, and you certainly get to know them and see all their stages and ages. But you have to make each minute count. So, you know, there isn't like the right time to have a child and the right time to be a grandparent or the right time to be a parent or the right time to find the right person. It's just as it happens, it happens. And then you just have to make the most of it, you know, by being in that moment. And that's why I wish I would have learned about Thich Nhat Hanh 100 years ago rather than just in the last 10. But this is what my journey is right now, to make the minute be special no matter what it is, and to not let fear ruin anything.
I like that. Make the journey be special. So as we finish off, I'm going to try something on this podcast. I'm going to say a word or a phrase, and I just want your quick reaction. We're going to rip through this list, and then and we'll get you out of here, okay?
Okay.
All right, so here's the first word. First thought or sentence that comes to mind. Vulnerability.
Letting others get into your head and heart.
California or New York City?
Both amazing places. I'd like to live in each place 6 months of each year if I had $1 million.
We would too. Huh? All right. Love.
What was that?
Love.
Love. Love everyone. It's like that old saying we raised you with about the canoe. Love many, trust few, but always remember to paddle your own canoe.
Yeah. All right. Travel.
See the world when you're younger and see what you can do as you learn each culture and respect each culture that you come in contact with.
Okay. How about grit?
Oh, always have it. You can never lose it. You can't live without it. It's like love. It's just the other side.
How about toughness?
You got to be tough. It goes with love. You got to be tough. You got to have grit. Got to have a good work ethic. And the love starts with loving yourself, you know, and then it goes towards others. But you got to start with yourself. And you only know how you love yourself by the toughness that you have and the grit that you put out there. That's
reading.
That internal motivation.
Reading.
Read something every day.
How about writing?
Write something every day.
Marriage.
It's a very special, unique experience. But when you have it happen, it's for keeps. You know, that's how you have to think about it, that it's a major commitment.
How about divorce?
It's very painful, and it's a loss for those who experience it.
Last couple. Your husband, Will Roth.
He's a special, great, good man.
How about your children?
Amazing in every way imaginable, but especially kind, because each one of them are doing things for others by making this world a better place.
How about the word limits?
Limit?
Yeah.
You're only as limited as your mind allows you to be, or your heart. I think sometimes your mind thinks that you have limitless possibilities, and then your heart might stop you from doing certain things. So, got to have heart with your limit.
Okay, so last two, right on cue with the cuckoo clock in the background there. Number one, Mom, what makes you feel most alive?
Most alive when I'm in the moment and being in a place where there's just more than just me.
Interesting. And then finally, in your definition, what's a full life?
A full life?
Yeah.
Is the kind of life that you do what you do every day, and at the end of the day, you say, today was a good day.
Mm.
I learned something today. Whether it's about me or someone else or the world, that's a full life.
You know, it's pretty interesting. I, as you know, I interview people for a living, and I can't tell you how many times in this conversation / interview where I've like just said, wow, which is really not a good response. Like, you should use a response with another question. And I've said that because I didn't know 90% of this stuff. And I'm curious, and I think other kids will be curious, just like they did when they saw Life in a Walk, to pose the question to you, why didn't you tell me these stories earlier? Is it because I didn't ask? Is it because you didn't want to share them? Well, why do you think parents, and then why don't parents tell kids these types of stories?
I think you've heard all these stories. You know, you just haven't heard them the way that you're hearing them today. Because the student is always at the foot of some master, as some master is always at the foot of some student. It's just the way you perceive and hear things at a certain stage in your lifetime is very different than hearing it at another point in your lifetime. There's nothing new that you don't know, we talked about today, except for maybe a few minor details here and there. But
what would your advice be?
I was a refugee. You knew all these things, that I lived in different places, and to, you know, all these other things.
Oh, I mean,
huh?
Regardless, before we let you go, what would you tell other kids, other sons and daughters who have these questions? Because all too often, you know, it's why, you know, like why we, Dad and I did the walk. You know, all too often we don't ask these questions that we seek the answers to. What's your advice from somebody who's worked in psychology, therapy, philosophy your entire life? What's your advice to other children who seek some answers from their parents?
Spend 5 minutes with them and ask them a question or two if you're so inclined. But, you know, you have to understand that you're an adult now, but as a kid, just think about your life. You know, at five, you had all your friends here because I was a stay-at-home mom. You had to play every sport imaginable from 7 in the morning until it got dark. You know, as a child, you just, you know, you grow up and you live your life fully in terms of whatever your relationship is to your friends and your interests. A five-year-old isn't just going to come to the dinner table and say, oh, so tell me about your life, Mom, you know, unless they're reading a book together. You know, we threw a lot of things at all of you whenever we had an opportunity. But you guys were very busy living your lives, and we were there to help you pick up the pieces or give you direction if you needed it, which, you know, of course you needed it.
Oh, no, still do. No,
no, I know. That's why with the Life Without Limits is great, but we got to get that heart to, you know, connect, which it does. And
Well, there's the pitch from Mom out there. Everybody, there it is.
But if a kid grows up to be an adult and then they're interested in stories because life is short.
Right.
And no. You did the most beautiful things in the world. That film was just extraordinary, really. And you have this very creative gift, but you were always like this. You know, as I'm rummaging through these papers and pictures and all kinds of things and all your stories that you wrote even in grade school, they're all about mystery and adventure and others. So, you know, you're living what you have always lived. It's just deeper now that you're growing up.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on. This was cool. You did great, by the way. You killed it.
Well, I can hardly wait. I can't imagine you listening to hours worth of my talking. My God.
We'll find out. We'll hear from people. But no, this is awesome. I'm pumped to have you on. And I know people are really going to enjoy it. And we'll start bringing you on pretty often, I think. I think we might have to get you every couple weeks, you know?
Okay, maybe, but listen to me. This is a lot of information. You're going to have to go through it. I mean, who knows what, if it even makes sense.
Oh, you did great. Well, thank you very much, Mom. I'll give you a holler later on, and I'm going to close up this podcast. So thanks for coming on.
Okay, so you will contact me later. I'm going to call you on your regular phone.
You got it.
Don't worry.
I'll call you in a few.
I love you, honey.
Right,
thanks. I'm
too.
Honored. I hope I taught you something minuscule, because you teach me more than you can ever dream of.
Oh,
did you hear all that?
I did. Thank you very much. All right, Mom. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. I love you, honey. Thanks. Thanks
too.
A lot.
So there it is. There's my mom. First podcast. And for me, it was really cool. You know, I literally caught myself saying, wow, so many times. I don't know how many you heard or not. And I know that's not like best journalist practice, but you know, I'm trying to ask questions that I really don't know the answers to. And I'm sure she's right. I'm sure there was times in my life where I asked her about being a kid, but I didn't know she spent 3 years in a refugee camp, you know, and I didn't know that she grew up with two guys in her household, one with one arm and one with one leg. And there's a lot of those things. But I think what it teaches us is that our parents come from such cool places. And I get it. Everybody's parents weren't, you know, born in Israel or spent time in Germany or, you know, on a big ship. But they all have a path and a story. And I really think that the point of this entire podcast is to get us to go seek that. You know, I've always kind of wondered where we come from, why we come from there, what's our makeup like, and who taught us those principles. And for me to kick off this podcast with my mom has just been awesome. I can't wait to share it with all of you. And as always, as I get going on this thing, provide feedback. You know, what do you think? What do you like? What do you want more of? We got some really cool guests lined up. I'm going to try to do a podcast fairly regularly, you know, every week to 10 days, especially in the off season before we dive into the football season. And I'm jacked about it. It's a new form of sharing. And cool is that to ask any question that you want to a parent, at least for me. That was really cool, you know. And I've been, I think since I did the film about my dad with our team, I know I've become a really vulnerable guy, you know, a psychologist, or my mom might say emotionally available. And that's totally true. And now I enjoy these conversations and these questions, and I enjoy sharing them with you if they can possibly be just a subtle nudge for you to pick up your phone or drive home and ask a question you don't know the answer to. So I want to thank you all. It has been an absolute blast. This is episode 1. How cool is this? And away we go. You can check us out at Blog Talk Radio, at yogirock.com. We're on iTunes now. I am fired up. So from episode 1 to all of you, let's keep going for it, huh? Try to live a life without limits and take some big risks along the way. All right, lots of love. Peace.